But without further ado, I invite Dr. Facer to come up on the podium and tell us about the immateriality of the mind, please.
Everybody hear me okay? All right, thank you so much. I didn't realize when I'd be coming that I'd be doing the morning equivalent of dinner theater. So we've got breakfast here. Some people are still partaking. My topic today is the immateriality of the mind, and I may prove it just by virtue of giving the talk since I'm still in Los Angeles time. So it's 6 a.m. for me. If I get through this, I will have proved my thesis. The independence of the intellect from the body. So we'll see how I do. I trust everyone's got the handout then, right? That's at the end of the table. So my aim in this talk is to present what I take to be the most important argument for the thesis that the mind is not material. In order to set the stage for the argument, it will be useful first to say a little bit about what I mean by mind and what I mean by material. Contemporary analytic philosophers commonly distinguish between three aspects of the mind which might appear to be inexplicable in materialist terms. Needless to say, not all philosophers think that any of these features really is, at the end of the day, inexplicable in materialist terms. The point is just that it is widely thought that if any mental phenomenon poses a problem for materialism, it will be one or more of these three. The three aspects are rationality, consciousness, and intentionality, as they're generally known in academic philosophy. Let me briefly characterize each of them. Rationality is our capacity to form abstract concepts, to put them together into complete thoughts or propositions, and to reason logically from one proposition to another. For example, we are able not only to perceive this or that particular man, but also to grasp the general idea or universal concept, man, which applies to every man that does exist, has existed, will exist, or could exist. We can take this concept and combine it with others to form complete thoughts, like the proposition that all men are mortal. And we can infer from propositions like all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, the conclusion that Socrates is mortal. Rationality, in this sense, is among animals unique to human beings. Consciousness is the awareness of one's external environment and internal goings-on that we and other animals have, and plants and non-living things do not. In contemporary analytic philosophy, consciousness is taken to be puzzling insofar as it is associated with qualia, the qualitative features of experience which, unlike ordinary material features, are directly accessible only from the first-person point of view of the subject of experience. For example, consider what happens when you slam a door on your hand. There is damage to the body, behavior such as letting out a yelp and wincing, and neural activity. All of this might in principle be observed by anybody. But there is also a feel to the experience, the quale of the pain, as philosophers like to call it, which is directly knowable only to you, from within the experience, as it were. The third puzzling aspect of the mind discussed by contemporary philosophers is intentionality, which is a technical term for the directedness toward an object that is exhibited by at least some mental states. For example, when you think about the Eiffel Tower, your thought is directed toward, or points at, or is about, that particular object. The intentionality of thoughts is the main example of intentionality discussed by contemporary philosophers, but conscious experiences of the kind even a non-human animal might have seem to exhibit intentionality too. For example, when you and a dog both see a cat, the dog's perceptual experience, no less than yours, is directed toward, points at, or is about the cat. This is true even though the dog does not conceptualize the cat the way that you do, given your rationality. Even plants might be claimed to exhibit intentionality of a very rudimentary sort. For example, a plant will grow toward the light of the sun, even though being non-rational, it does not conceptualize the sun the way that you do, and being non-sentient, it is not conscious of the sun the way that a non-human animal can be. Thinkers like Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, and Descartes took rationality, which is distinctive of human beings, to be the key to the immateriality of the mind. As will be obvious from the argument I'm going to defend in this talk, I think they were exactly right about that. However, contemporary philosophers tend to focus instead on consciousness and intentionality as posing the most obvious challenge to materialism, and some of them even seem to think that rationality is relatively easy to account for a materialist to account for. The reason they think rationality is relatively easy to account for is that they suppose that the currently popular thesis that the brain is a kind of computer and the mind is the software that runs on the computer essentially solves the problem of assimilating rationality to matter. Now, in my view, that supposition is not only false, but so deeply fallacious and incoherent that it is a wonder that anyone takes it seriously. I like to make modest claims, as you'll see. But explaining why I say that requires some stage setting, so I'll come back to the topic of minds and computers later on. The reason contemporary philosophers think consciousness and intentionality are much harder to account for has to do with a battery of arguments that have become well known even outside of philosophy in recent decades. For example, there is Frank Jackson's knowledge argument, which holds that you could know everything that possibly could be known about the physics and physiology of color perception, and yet still not know from that alone what it is like to see a color that you hadn't seen before. There is David Chalmers' zombie argument, as it's called, which holds that there could, in theory, be a creature which is a particle for particle duplicate of a human being, and yet is totally devoid of consciousness. Such arguments are meant to show that facts about qualia and consciousness are facts over and above the physical facts. What is called the Swamp Man thought experiment asks us to imagine a creature that is a particle for particle duplicate of a human being, but is devoid of any intentionality. The possibility, at least in principle, of such a creature is taken to show that facts about intentionality are facts over and above the physical facts, and so on. Now, I'm not going to say anything further about these sorts of arguments, because in my opinion, they're not of direct relevance to the aim of establishing the immateriality of the mind. That is not because I think that they don't have force against materialism. On the contrary, I think they are decisive refutations of materialism. The reason, though, has nothing to do with the nature of the mind. It has instead to do with the materialist conception of matter. Materialism is inherited from Galileo, Descartes, Locke, and other early modern thinkers, a highly mathematicized conception of the material world, according to which matter possesses only quantifiable primary qualities like spatial location, motion, size, and the like, and is devoid of anything corresponding to the so-called secondary qualities like color, odor, sound, taste, heat, and cold, at least as common sense understands these qualities, as opposed to the way they're redefined in physics, say. On this view, if we want to redefine a quality, like being red, for example, in terms of an object's tendency to absorb certain wavelengths of light and reflect others, then we can say that an apple is red. But if by red we mean what common sense understands by red, namely the way that red looks to a normal observer but would not look to someone who is colorblind, then there is nothing in the apple itself that corresponds to that, according to this primary-secondary quality distinction that goes back to the early moderns. And the same goes for other colors and for flavors, smells, sounds, and the like. Irreducibly qualitative features were taken by the early modern philosophers and scientists to exist only as the qualia of conscious experience, part of the veil of perceptions through which we are aware of the material world, but not part of the material world itself. Now, if you're going to define matter that way, then you have already implicitly committed yourself to a kind of dualism, whether you realize it or not. For if you say that color, odor, sound, taste, smell, etc., again, at least as common sense understands those features, do not exist in matter, then that entails that they do not exist in the brain, since the brain is no less the material than the objects outside it. But if you also go on to say that these qualities do exist in the mind, in our conscious awareness of matter, then you are saying that the mind is not material. In this way, dualism of a broadly Cartesian sort is by no means some rearguard resistance to the modern scientific mode of explanation, but on the contrary, follows from it. Indeed, early modern thinkers like Malebranche and Ralph Cudworth emphasized this. Oddly, contemporary philosophers and scientists alike seem mostly blind to the fact that Cartesian dualism is rooted in the modern scientific conception of matter, though Schrödinger was one scientist who saw this connection, and Thomas Nagel is one contemporary philosopher who sees it. Now, what is true of qualia is also true of intentionality. For another key aspect of the mathematicized conception of matter is that it leaves out anything smacking of Aristotle's notion of final cause or teleology. Teleology essentially involves the things being directed or pointed towards some end or goal. For example, an acorn might be said to be directed toward the end of becoming an oak, or the eye might be said to be directed toward the end of enabling an organism to see. To say that matter is devoid of teleology is therefore to say that there is no such directedness that's really built into it. But intentionality is a species of directedness. Hence, if there is no teleology inherent in matter, there is no intentionality inherent in matter. But intentionality does exist in the mind, in particular in our thoughts, since a thought is always directed toward a certain object or subject matter, and in our choices, which are directed toward the realization of certain goals. Hence, to affirm that there is intentionality in the mind, while endorsing a mathematicized conception of matter, from which teleology is absent, is implicitly to commit yourself to a kind of dualism. Insofar as modern materialism is committed to a mathematicized conception of matter, then, it contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. To point this out, however, is not necessarily to establish thereby the immateriality of the mind, because rather than drawing the conclusion that qualia and intentionality are immaterial, one could instead simply reject the mathematicized conception of matter. Note that this would not require one to hold that the mathematicized conception of matter is false, a claim which would, of course, be a tough sell given the great utility that this conception has had in modern science. Rather, one could hold instead that the mathematicized conception of matter is incomplete, that it captures part of the nature of the material world but not all of it. This is the view taken by a view in philosophy of science known as epistemic structural realism, according to which physics captures the abstract mathematical structure of matter but not its intrinsic nature. Bertrand Russell was an early to mid-20th century philosopher who took this position, and in recent years, interest in the view has been revived by philosophers of science like John Worrell and philosophers of mind like David Chalmers and Galen Strawson. Now, if one adopts this structural realist view, one could then go in any of several further directions in dealing with qualia and intentionality. For example, some have gone in an idealist or panpsychist direction, and argue that qualia are the intrinsic properties of all matter, of which physics gives us only the structure. This is essentially to reduce matter to mind, rather than mind to matter. Or one could go instead in a neo-Aristotelian direction, holding that teleology is a real feature of the material world after all, and that color and other so-called secondary qualities exist in matter, more or less than just the way common sense supposes they do. In that case, consciousness and intentionality would turn out to be material after all, because there would be more to matter than the mathematicized conception of matter countenances. But I won't pursue these issues any further in this talk, because, as I've said, I think that rationality, rather than consciousness or intentionality, is the key to understanding why the mind is immaterial. And the arguments for the immaterial nature of rationality go through whether one endorses a mathematicized conception of matter, or an Aristotelian conception, or some other conception. So for present purposes, we can simply bracket off this dispute about the nature of matter. So we turn then to what I take to be the main argument for the immateriality of the mind, or the one I want to focus on anyway. The specific argument for the immateriality of our rational faculties that I want to present here has its roots in Plato and Aristotle, but was given especially trenchant expression by the late Catholic philosopher James Ross of the University of Pennsylvania. He died just a few years ago. In his 1992 Journal of Philosophy article, Immaterial Aspects of Thought, and his 2008 book, Thought and World. I've defended and elaborated on Ross's argument myself in several publications, but will confine myself here to setting out the main thrust of the argument. Now, the basic idea of the argument is very simple and can be stated in the form of a syllogism. The real work comes in defending the premises of the syllogism. The syllogism itself is as follows, and you should see it there on your handout. Step one, formal thought processes, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. Formal thought processes can have an exact or unambiguous conceptual content, whereas step two, nothing material can have an exact or unambiguous conceptual content. Therefore, our conclusion three, formal thought processes are not material. Now, the syllogism is valid. That is to say, if we accept those premises, we have to accept the conclusion. So why should we accept the premises? Let's begin with the second premise, and with a very elementary and intuitive example to set the stage for the more technical and abstract sorts of examples to which Ross appeals in his own formulation of the argument. Consider a simple pictorial representation, such as a drawing of a triangle. Just think of a black isosceles triangle, say. What is the content of that representation? Does it represent triangularity in the abstract, or only black triangles specifically, or maybe only black isosceles triangles, even more specifically? Does it represent something else instead, such as a pyramid, or a dunce cap, or a slice of pizza? There's nothing in the physical properties of the representation that can tell us. Studying the size of the image, the thickness of its lines, the chemistry of the ink in which it is drawn, or the like, will not provide an answer to the question. For whatever the list of the thing's physical properties turns out to contain, they will all be compatible with various alternative possible attributions of conceptual content to the picture. Notice that the situation does not change even if we add something to the picture, such as the word triangle written under the image. For one thing, that particular sequence of shapes or sounds counts as a word in the first place, suppose just a random set of squiggles, let alone a word with specific meaning that the word triangle has nothing to do with its physical properties. It's entirely a matter of convention. For another thing, even given the customary meaning of the word, there are still alternative possible interpretations of this revised image with the word written under it. For example, it could represent triangles themselves, or it could represent instead the English word triangle. Or it could even represent the obscure 1970s Japanese pop band Triangle. There really was such a thing. I checked. Wikipedia does not lie. Again, nothing in the physical properties of the word and image can suffice to tell us precisely what conceptual content they convey. This will be true no matter what further details we add to the image. There will always be alternative possible interpretations. The physical properties of any material representation are indeterminate or ambiguous with respect to its content. Whatever conceptual content it turns out to have will have to be determined by something outside these properties. Now, James Ross, when he developed this argument, deployed an example borrowed from the contemporary philosopher Saul Kripke to drive the point home. Suppose you had never computed any numbers as large as 57, but are asked to compute 68 plus 57. You answer 125, confident not only that this is the arithmetically correct answer, but also that it accords with the way that you've always used the word plus, namely to denote the addition function, which, when applied to the numbers 68 and 57, yields 125. But now, Kripke says, imagine that some bizarre skeptic asks you how you can be sure that this is really what you meant by the word plus in the past, and therefore how you can be sure that 125 really is the right answer. Perhaps our skeptic suggests what you really meant in the past by the plus, by the word plus and by the plus symbol was not addition, but rather what Kripke calls the quus function, which can be defined as follows. And you should see this on the bottom of your, the front of your handout. You define the quus function as follows. X quus y is the same as x plus y if x and y are less than 57, but it equals 5 otherwise. Okay, this should sound weird. It's supposed to, okay? Now, in that case, what you would always have been carrying out was really what Kripke calls quaddition rather than addition. Since quadding or quadding, I'm not sure if it's quadding or quadding, it doesn't matter. Since quadding and adding numbers will always yield the same result when the numbers are smaller than 57. That would entail that now that you were computing 68 plus 57, the correct answer would be 5 rather than 125. And perhaps, our skeptic proposes, you think otherwise because you are now misinterpreting all of your past previous usages of the English word plus and of the plus sign. This all seems absurd, of course, but how can you know that the skeptic is wrong? Now, Kripke has his own uses for this example, but what Ross emphasizes, and it's Ross's use of it, his adaptation of it that I want to focus on here, what Ross emphasizes is that nothing in the facts about your behavior or your neurophysiology or any other physical aspect of human nature can determine that what you were really doing was addition rather than quaddition. For example, it's no use appealing to the fact that what you've always said in the past is, quote, 2 plus 2 equals 4, rather than, quote, 2 plus 2 equals 4, because what's at issue is what you meant by the word plus. The skeptic will say that it may be that every time you said plus, what you really meant was the quaddition function. Nor will it help even to call to mind memories of your having had visual or auditory mental images of the sentence 2 plus 2 equals 4, rather than the sentence 2 plus 2 equals 4, because what is in question is the meaning that you attach to these sounds and shapes. Even if you were to insist that whatever you meant in the past, what you now mean by plus is addition rather than quaddition, the skeptic will still ask how you can know that. And Ross and Kripke would point out that to answer the question, it will not suffice to point out that you here and now utter sentences like 2 plus 2 equals 4 rather than sentences like 2 plus 2 equals 4, or that you here and now bring mental images of the first sentence to mind rather than the second, because the question is what meaning you attach here and now to these words and shapes. Nor will it help to appeal to what is going on in your nervous system, because in order to know that such and such neural activity is associated with addition rather than quaddition, we first have to know that you really are, at any particular moment, carrying out addition rather than quaddition, so that we can establish a correlation between addition on the one hand and the neural activity in question on the other. In other words, any neurophysiological criterion that we could appeal to would have to presuppose that we already know that you are adding rather than quadding, and thus it couldn't by itself establish that you are. Notice that it's completely irrelevant that most of us have in fact computed numbers larger than 57, because for any person there's always some number, even if a very large one, higher than which he has never computed. And Kripke's imagined skeptic can always run his argument using that number instead of 57. Notice also that there is nothing special about the word plus. An example parallel to Kripke's could be constructed for any term in the English language, or in any language for that matter, so that the lesson Ross draws is that there is nothing in the material facts about human nature, nothing about the facts of our behavior or our physiology or our neurophysiology specifically and so forth, nothing in the material facts about human nature that can suffice to determine the meaning or conceptual content of any sentence or of any other material representation. Again, the physical properties of any material representation are by themselves ambiguous with respect to their conceptual content. And this is true of any alleged material representations encoded in the brain as it would be of words written on paper, say. Contemporary analytic philosophers refer to this phenomenon as the indeterminacy of meaning, and it's a big theme in writers like W.V. Quine, for example, and Daniel Dennett and others. So that gives us premise two of our syllogism. Now, a materialist might conclude from this that none of the sentences we utter, and indeed none of the thoughts we have, has any exact, unambiguous, or determinate conceptual content. You might just go in that direction. And indeed, philosophers like Quine and Dennett, to whom I just referred, have concluded just that from arguments like the one just given, from arguments like Kripke's. For if you hold, as materialism does, that the physical facts are all the facts that there are, but then concede that those facts are not sufficient to determine that a material representation has one meaning rather than another, then you have to judge that there just is no fact of the matter about whether a material representation has that one meaning rather than another. For example, you have to judge that there is no objective fact of the matter about whether we really carry out addition rather than quaddition. Of course, we take ourselves to be doing addition, and it would be bizarre to try to interpret ourselves as doing anything else. But for materialists like the ones I'm describing, materialists like Quine and Dennett, that's merely a pragmatic choice on our part. It doesn't reflect anything about the objective physical facts, just about the utility of thinking ourselves as adding rather than carrying out this weird quaddition function that Kripke describes. But this brings us to premise one of Ross's syllogism, which again is the premise that formal thought processes can have an exact or unambiguous determinate content. Ross holds that all of our thoughts do in fact have some determinate or unambiguous or exact conceptual content, but the clearest examples involve formal thinking, so he focuses on those. Formal thinking is the kind familiar from mathematics and formal logic. Adding and subtracting, squaring a number, reasoning through the steps of an AAA one-form categorical syllogism, or applying inference rules like modus ponens and modus tollens would be examples. Modus ponens would be the form, if P is true, then Q is true, therefore Q is. Or modus tollens, if P is true, Q is not true, P must not be either. Now, to claim, as some materialists do, that there's no objective fact of the matter, about what any of our thoughts or utterances mean entails that there is no objective fact of the matter about whether we are ever really adding, squaring, applying modus ponens, and so on. But that, Ross argues, cannot possibly be right. There are four reasons why. First, it is from a phenomenological point of view bizarre to suppose that there is no fact of the matter about whether any of us is, for example, really adding right now. You just try to look within your own consciousness and tell yourself, there's no fact one way or the other about whether I'm adding. This is, to say the very least, a bizarre suggestion. So compute 10 plus 10 in your mind right now. Is it remotely plausible to say that there is no objective right answer to the question whether you were just now carrying out addition rather than quaddition? Suppose we were to follow, for the sake of argument, that that is possible, at least in principle. Why should we have more confidence in the theory that leads us to such a bizarre result than we have in the phenomenological evidence, the evidence from our own consciousness, that we really are adding? Moreover, if the phenomenology could be wrong about something like this, how can we be confident that it is right about anything else? For example, if we are getting it wrong when making judgments about the conceptual content of our thoughts, how do we know we aren't also getting it wrong when making judgments about the conceptual content of our perceptual experiences? And in that case, what happens to the observational and experimental evidence upon which physical science rests? For example, if a scientist takes himself to be having a perceptual experience of seeing that the needle on a dial is pointing to a certain number, how could he be sure that he isn't really having an experience of some very different sort? We could be wrong about the conceptual content of our thoughts, we could be wrong about everything, including all the perceptual evidence on which science rests. That's one problem. Second problem is that it's hard to see how the thesis that there is no objective fact of the matter about the content of our formal thought processes can be squared with the existence of the vast body of knowledge that comprises the disciplines of mathematics and formal logic. Nor is it just that mathematics and logic constitute genuine bodies of knowledge in their own right. They are also presupposed by the natural sciences. So once again, to deny that any of our thoughts or utterances has any unambiguous or determinate conceptual content seems to undermine the very possibility of natural science. A third and related problem is that if we never really ever apply modus ponens or modus tollens or any other form of logical inference, then it would follow that none of the arguments we give is ever really a valid argument. Because none of them actually, there's no fact of the matter about whether any of them conforms to some valid rule of inference. But this would include the arguments of materialist philosophers like Quine and Dennett, who deny that our thoughts and utterances ever really have any exact or determinate conceptual content. Hence, that view is self-defeating. Even if it were true, we could never be rationally justified in believing it's true, because we could never be rationally justified in believing anything if they were correct. Fourth, the claim that we never really add or square a number or apply modus ponens or the like is self-defeating in an even more direct and fatal way. For coherently to deny that we ever really do any of these things presupposes that we at least have a grasp of what it would be to do them. And that means having thoughts with conceptual content as unambiguous as those which materialists like Quine and Dennett say we do not have. In particular, to deny that we ever really add, for example, requires that we unambiguously grasp what it is to add and then go on to deny that we ever really do that. Or to deny that we ever really apply modus ponens requires that we unambiguously grasp what it is to reason via modus ponens, what it would be to reason via modus ponens, and then go on to deny that we ever really do that, and so forth. Yet the whole point of denying that we ever really add or apply modus ponens, etc., was to avoid having to admit that we at least sometimes have thought processes with an unambiguous or exact conceptual content. So to deny that we have them presupposes that we have them. It simply cannot coherently be done. And so we have Ross's argument. Again, premise one tells us that formal thought processes can have an exact or unambiguous conceptual content, as is evidenced from the fact that, as we've just seen, even the act of denying that they have such content commits us implicitly to affirming that they do have it. And premise two tells us that nothing material can have an exact or unambiguous conceptual content, as even materialists like Quine and Dennett acknowledge on the basis of arguments like Kripke's. From these premises, we get our conclusion, namely that formal thought processes are not material. Now let's consider some potential objections to this sort of argument. First of all, a charge commonly made by materialists is that to affirm the immateriality of the mind is to be committed to the existence of a spooky kind of mind stuff, or ectoplasm, kind of stuff flowing through the sewers in Ghostbusters, if you've seen that movie, right? Developing this accusation, the materialist may then ask why representations made out of ectoplasm or mind stuff would be any more capable of having an exact or unambiguous conceptual content than material representations are. The idea is that indeterminacy of meaning would afflict material and immaterial stuff alike, so that it gives us no reason to affirm the immateriality of the mind. So that's a common objection. But common though this sort of objection is, it's aimed at a straw man. You won't find Plato or Aristotle or Aquinas or Descartes or any other major defender of the immateriality of the mind asserting the existence of anything like ectoplasm or mind stuff. Maybe 19th century British spiritualists, they'll talk about that kind of stuff, but that's nothing to do with the history of Western philosophy. For one thing, these thinkers don't think of the mind as composed of stuff of any kind, precisely because they don't think of it as composed at all, but rather as simple or non-composite. Ectoplasm is also supposed to be a kind of gauzy substance that emanates from a medium during a seance, is visible under certain conditions, and so it can be photographed. Once again, check Wikipedia. You'll see the ectoplasm photographs, right? Okay. In other words, it's not really immaterial at all, as thinkers like Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Aquinas think of immateriality, but just an exotic kind of matter. Obviously, then, it's the last thing that defenders of the immateriality of thought would associate with the mind. So that's the first problem with it. It's just aimed at a straw man. No, none of these thinkers are committed to anything like that. More to the present point, the materialist objection under consideration presupposes that the defender of the mind's immateriality is positing two things, namely an immaterial thought on the one hand and the conceptual content of that thought on the other, as if they're distinct, separable things. And just as with a material representation, we can ask which of various possible conceptual contents it has, so too, according to the objection in question, we can ask of an immaterial thought which of various possible conceptual contents it has. Somehow the thought and its content can come apart, so that indeterminacy of meaning, as this objection holds, can follow in both cases. But this too simply misunderstands the nature of the claim that the mind is immaterial. For in fact, the view denies that there is a distinction to be drawn between an immaterial thought on the one hand and its conceptual content on the other. Rather, there is just one thing, not two things that might come apart, the way that a material representation and its conceptual content can come apart. Scholastic philosophers, thinkers in the tradition of Thomas Aquinas, sometimes make the point by drawing a distinction between material signs, also called instrumental signs on the one hand, and formal signs on the other. A material sign is double-natured. It's got a dual nature. That is to say, it's both a sign and also something else, namely an entity in its own right, like a set of ink marks or compression waves in the air if it's a spoken word or something like that. The smoke that we take to be a sign of fire, the red and white striped pole that functions as the sign of a barbershop, and written and spoken words are all material signs in that they can be characterized entirely apart from their status as signs, in terms of their chemical composition, for example, or their texture or their shape. By contrast, formal signs, as Francis Parker and Henry Veitch, two 20th century Thomistic philosophers point out. Parker and Veitch say that formal signs, quote, do not have traits which must be known before their significance is known. They are not means, things which have meaning. Rather, they are themselves meanings. They are signs and nothing but signs. They have no nature other than their signifying nature. That's from their book, Logic as a Human Instrument. Now, examples of such signs would be concepts and propositions. Neither a concept nor a proposition, a concept like the concept being a man or the concept being mortal, nor a proposition like the complete thought, all men are mortal, has any nature other than being about whatever it is about. It makes sense to suppose that a material sign might not have been about anything, but it makes no sense to suppose that a concept or proposition might not have been about anything. These are signs that are nothing but signs, unlike a sentence or a picture or something like that. Now, if there was still any really any doubt about whether there are such things as formal signs in this sense, there's a fairly intuitive argument for their existence, which is suggested by Parker and Veitch, the two authors I just quoted. Precisely because material signs and their content are separable, we cannot read off the content or the meaning from the nature that they have apart from their status as signs, and have to determine their meaning by reference to other signs, as we do when we check a dictionary to see how one word is defined by reference to other words. But if every sign were like that, if every sign were a material sign, we'd be led to a vicious regress, either into a circle or an infinite regress. Hence, there must be signs which just are their meanings, and which therefore need not be known by reference to other signs, and can serve as the terminus of explanation of those signs that do need to be explained by reference to others. And they would have to be immaterial, since if they were material, there, you know, you'd have this indeterminacy problem that I've been speaking about. So that's one objection and how it responds to that. A second possible objection to the argument for the immateriality of the mind that I've been defending might be to appeal to the existence of computers as a counterexample to what I've been claiming. For computers, the critic might say, have an unambiguous or exact conceptual content, even though they are purely material. Nobody claims computers have immortal souls, right? The minute I say it, I realize there's somebody who will claim anything. So you'll find somebody on the web who does, I'm sure, but that's a rare claim. Okay, so computers are purely material, but don't they have an unambiguous or exact content? For example, when you use an ordinary pocket calculator, you are surely doing addition and not quaddition. And that's just a fact of the matter, even though the thing's purely material. Now, perhaps it is obvious what is wrong with this objection, which is that Kripke's quaddition example, in fact, does apply to computers no less than it does to human neurophysiology and behavior, as Kripke himself pointed out. For there are no physical features of a computer that can by themselves determine whether it is carrying out addition or quaddition, no matter how far we extend its outputs. No matter what the past behavior of a machine has been, we can always suppose that its next output, 5, say, when calculating numbers larger than any that it has calculated before, might show that it is carrying out something like quaddition rather than addition. Now, of course, it might be said that, in response, that if that happens, that would just show that the machine was malfunctioning rather than performing quaddition. But Kripke points out that whether some output counts as a malfunction itself depends on what program the machine is running. And whether the machine is running the program for addition rather than quaddition is precisely what is in question. So to just say it's a malfunction, period, would be to beg the question. Another way to put the point is that the question of what program a machine is running always involves idealization. In any actual machine, gears tend to get stuck or components will melt, and in myriad other ways, the machine fails perfectly to instantiate the program that we say it is running. But there's nothing in the physical features or operations of the machine themselves that can tell us that it has failed perfectly to instantiate its idealized program. For relative to an eccentric program, even a machine with a stuck gear or melted component could be doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing, and a gear that doesn't stick or a component that doesn't melt could count as malfunctioning. Hence, there is nothing in the behavior of a computer considered by itself that can tell us whether it's giving 125 in response to what is 68 plus 57 counts as an instance of following an idealized program for addition, or instead as a malfunction in a machine that is supposed to be carrying out an idealized program for quaddition. And there's nothing in the behavior of a computer considered by itself, that's the key qualifier here, that could tell us whether giving 5 in response to the question, what is 68 plus 57, counts as a malfunction in a machine that is supposed to be carrying out an idealized program for addition, or instead as an instance of properly following an idealized program for quaddition. Of course, we could always ask the programmer of the machine whether it is addition or quaddition that he had in mind. But that simply reinforces Kripke's point that there is nothing in the physical properties of the machine itself that can tell us. The reason we can say with confidence that a computer really is carrying out addition rather than quaddition is, of course, that people program machines to carry out addition, and they don't program them to carry out quaddition. But then, strictly speaking, the exact or unambiguous content is in the minds of these programmers and not in the machines themselves. And these human minds, as I've been arguing, are immaterial. Hence, it either misses the point or begs the question to appeal to computers as if they show that there could be exact or unambiguous conceptual content in the absence of something immaterial. Now, this also shows why it's a mistake to think that rationality can be explained in materialist terms by thinking of the mind as software running on the hardware of the brain, to return to this theme I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Addition is a rational thought process. So if rationality in general can be explained in terms of the computer model of the mind, then addition in particular should be explicable in those terms. But we've seen why it cannot be explained in those terms. Again, no collection of purely material facts can by themselves determine that you were carrying out addition rather than quaddition, and therefore no collection of purely material facts about the brain can determine that it is running a program for addition rather than a program for quaddition. So since you are in fact carrying out addition rather than quaddition, there must be more going on with this rational thought process than merely the running of a program. The same thing is true for all other rational thought processes, because a parallel quaddition style argument could be run for any of them. Nor will it do to suggest that natural selection has determined that the brain is following one program rather than another. For any program we conjecture natural selection has put into us, there is going to be an alternative program with equal survival value, and the biological facts will be insufficient to determine which of them is the one that we are actually following. For example, suppose it's suggested that the capacity for addition has survival value, and thus would have been favored by natural selection. In that case, it might be thought, we have good reason to think, that the brain is running the program for addition. The problem is that we could also postulate instead that the brain is running a program for something like quaddition, because there's always going to be a form of quaddition that will yield exactly the same results as addition in all cases where survival depends upon it. So there's no argument from natural selection for the conclusion that the brain is running a program for addition that wouldn't also be an equally good argument for the conclusion that the brain is running a program for quaddition. Hence, the appeal to natural selection fails to salvage the view that rationality can be explained in terms of the computer model of the mind. Now, there are other powerful objections to the computer model of the mind, though as with the anti-materialist arguments from consciousness and intentionality, one of the objections that I think is especially powerful has force only insofar as it turns the materialist's own mathematicized conception of matter against him. What I have in mind is an objection developed by John Searle, UC Berkeley philosopher John Searle, though what I'm going to describe is not Searle's famous Chinese room argument, which some of you might have heard of, but rather a different and, in my view, deeper argument that he developed in later work, around 1990 or so, I believe. As Searle points out, a scientific account of the mind would have to appeal to observer-independent features of the material world. For the existence of the observer is precisely what such an account is supposed to be explaining. If it explained the existence of the mind, and thus of the observer, in terms of observer-relative features, it would be viciously circular. It would be explaining the existence of the observer in terms of observer-relative features, and the existence of the observer relative features in terms of the existence of the observer. Okay, and that would be a pseudo-explanation. Now, the trouble with the computer model of the mind, Searle argues, is that the key features to which it appeals are precisely observer relative in nature. A computer processes representations or symbols, for example, the ones and zeros of binary code, by implementing an algorithm. But nothing counts as the implementation of an algorithm, or as a one or a zero or any other representation, apart from an observer who assigns this interpretation to the relevant physical processes. For example, what a calculator does counts as arithmetic only because it had designers who intended that its processes be taken as arithmetical calculations. So it makes no sense to try to explain the existence of the mind in terms of the notion of a computer, because something counts as a computer only relative to the mind. The computer model of the mind thus puts the cart before the horse. Now, it seems to me that Searle's argument is unanswerable given that the materialist presupposes what I referred to earlier as a mathematicized conception of matter. The reason is that the key computational notions presuppose intentionality or directedness toward an object, which the mathematicized conception of matter rules out in the way I described earlier. For any representation or symbol, even one as rudimentary as a string of ones and zeros, is a representation only insofar as it is directed toward or pointed at some object of representation. The whole idea of representation is an inherently intentional concept, as philosophers put it. It involves something aiming or pointing beyond itself. And the trouble with this, as I noted earlier, is that a purely mathematicized conception of matter strips from matter anything that smacks of Aristotelian final causality or teleology. Hence, there can be nothing like directedness toward an object on a mathematicized conception of matter, and thus, given that conception of matter, nothing like the representations or symbols can exist in matter except in an observer-relative way. Now, that does not by itself suffice to prove that there is, in fact, nothing like algorithms or computation in the natural world, because, as I've said before, one could instead argue that the mathematicized conception of matter is incomplete. One could go in that direction and take the neo-Aristotelian position that there really are teleological features built into nature after all. On this interpretation, when contemporary biologists and physicists make use of notions like information processing, algorithms, and the like, in describing natural processes, when they use this computational language, they are inadvertently rediscovering something like Aristotelian teleology built into nature. Now, I am myself very sympathetic to that view, but it's not my purpose at the moment to defend it. The point is just that a reconsideration of Aristotle would provide the materialist with some resources by which he could mount a response to Searle, though I imagine that for any materialist, a return to teleology would be too high a price to pay. In any event, even this move would not save the view that rationality, specifically, can be explained by thinking of the brain as a kind of computer, for the reasons given by Kripke and Ross, in which I explained earlier. Even if we might think of the consciousness and intentionality that we share with the lower animals in computational terms, no material object, not even the brain, conceived of as a kind of computer, can have the exact or unambiguous conceptual content that characterizes the rational thought processes that are distinctive of us human beings. Thank you.
For Dr. Facer, and there is a microphone. Please use it since we are recording the session.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for a great lecture. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions, if you don't mind. I just want to make sure I understand you clearly. My first question is, I guess my first question that I wrote down is, why does mathematical matter or a mathematical view of matter forbid teleology? If I designed a DVD player, I need to use a mathematical view of matter, but that DVD player still is teleological towards playing DVDs. Would that fall in line with, is the answer to my question basically, if you study the ink of a stop sign or a barber pole, you won't find out what its teleology is by studying the atoms of it? Am I understanding that?
There are a couple questions there and a couple points I want to make in response. So just to take the last part first, part of what I'm saying, yes, is that if you study just the chemistry of the ink marks of a representation written on paper like these representations are, or the physical properties of a barber pole, you're not going to discover the intentionality it has, what its representational content is. That's true. But there's more to it than that. And as far as the mathematicized conception of matter is concerned, I wasn't saying that the mathematicized conception of matter positively excludes teleology. I don't think it does. My point was just that it doesn't capture it either. It's neutral as to that question. What excludes teleology is the idea that the mathematical conception of matter is an exhaustive conception of matter. That's where the potential problem lies, right? So if you give a mathematical description of matter and you say nothing more about it, that by itself leaves it open that there might be features over and above the mathematics that haven't been captured by it. The teleology is excluded only if you go on to add that if it's not captured by the mathematics, if it's not captured by the language of mathematical physics, say, then it's therefore not real. That's what would rule out teleology. But we're not forced to take that view.
Thank you so much for that clarification. I think if I... Is it okay if I have one more question, or do you want to give other... Thank you for your time.
We take the immateriality of the mind as a given on the basis of rationality. Do we have to then come up with some explanation of how that connects to the physical and the connection. He talked about ectoplasm, but then do we have to come up with some answer or philosophically or in some other means to explain how when someone's joyful that connects to their physical response, for example?
Right. Well, we do. I mean, if we want a complete philosophy of human nature, we want to understand how this immateriality relates to the material features of our nature. Naturally, we need to say more than just asserting or even just concluding and demonstrating that the mind is immaterial. That's a question I didn't address, though, because it raises all sorts of further controversial matters. So there are any number of options you could take. You could, for example, take a broadly Platonic Cartesian view, right? The idea that the mind relates to, and the psychological side of human nature relates to the rest of our nature, relates to our bodily nature, in something like the way that, you know, you relate to your car as you drive it down the freeway, right? The car is not part of you, it's a vehicle that you temporarily walk or drive around and so forth. And so if you're a Cartesian, I mean, Descartes himself wanted to resist this implication. He, in fact, explicitly did it. He says the mind is not in the body the way a pilot's in a ship. The problem, though, is that he has a hard time explaining why it's not, given the way he characterizes the mind. Right. And the way he characterizes it as a res cogitans, as a thing that thinks and nothing more than that. So Descartes' form of dualism, philosophers call it substance dualism, says that a human being is really a composite of two independent substances that could, in theory, have existed apart from one another. There are other defenders of the immateriality of the mind, though, who wouldn't go that direction. So Aristotle and Aquinas both take the mind to be immaterial, but they wouldn't go in Descartes' direction. They don't think of a human being as a kind of mashup of two different substances, but rather they take a human being to be one substance of which the intellect is one immaterial power, the rest of our powers, digestion, reproduction, locomotion, being bodily or material. So that for them, the soul is related to the body as form is to matter, and the intellect is a power of the soul among alongside its corporeal powers. But as all that just indicates, I mean, I've summed it up in 2 minutes, but it raises a whole host of other issues. Now, I tend to favor the Aristotelian position rather than the Cartesian position, but someone could accept the argument of this paper and go in a Plato or Descartes direction instead. So I just wanted to bracket that off for purposes of this particular talk. But you're absolutely right that those questions would have to be addressed by anyone who affirms the immateriality of the mind.
First, thank you very much for a wonderful talk. My question has to do with evolution. It's been said that if you think dogs don't understand numbers, try showing the dog 3 treats and then giving him only 2. So my question is, to what extent do we find rationality in the upper animals, and how does that impinge on your argument?
Yeah. I guess I, you know, first thing I wanted to say is the dog's really quadding rather than adding. But but the serious point behind that little quip of mine is that I would say what the dog is, the dog has a perceptual and imaginative capacity to respond in a way that loosely parallels or mimics what we would call noting the difference between 2 and 3. But there's none of the conceptual content that's associated with us when we distinguish 2 from 3. So whatever the dog is doing, it's not adding or quadding. It's something sub-rational, and so it's sub-arithmetical, I would say, even though it bears a kind of loose analogy to what we're doing. The thing is that the word rationality is fairly slippery, and so sometimes we describe all kinds of diverse things as rational. And so there's obviously a loose sense in which what the dog does is rational, or what, you know, what any animal does in evading a predator is rational. But what the dog or the other non-human animal is not doing is conceptualizing a predator or conceptualizing the treat that it only gets 2 of rather than 3 and so on and so forth. So I think once we disambiguate the term, we see that there's nothing really there that corresponds to what we're doing. We do rationality. I always like an example from Noam Chomsky's, who's critical of the idea that apes can really be taught language, and he somewhere compares it to claiming that that's like saying if you teach your dog to jump really high, it's now approximating flying. You know, you've taught it to fly. Well, you haven't. You've taught it something that really, if you squint, kind of sort of looks vaguely like flying. And I think what the dog is doing or what apes are doing kind of sort of looks like they were engaging in rationality of our sort, but only if you squint and ignore all the glaring differences and focus only on the relatively trivial similarities.
Hi, thank you for your talk. My question may be related to the relationship with physicality, and maybe you don't want to open that can of worms, but I have difficulty understanding how a mind can change, right? A mind as an immaterial thing is not in time. And so this is related to the problem of learning, the problem of the mind encompassing new concepts. Can you comment at all on how a mind can undergo any change?
Well, that's an excellent question. The question was, if for those who didn't hear it, was how a mind, if it's immaterial, is susceptible of change. Now, here's another place where we get into the details of the differences between different schools of thought that are committed to the immateriality of the mind. And what I have in mind in particular is the idea that for the Aristotelian tradition, the Aristotelian Thomistic approach to understanding the immateriality of the mind, you might say, just barely escapes being, human beings, I should say, just barely escape being entirely material. Because even our intellects are weak enough that their ordinary mode of operation requires, as Aquinas puts it, recourse to the phantasms, by which that's just Thomistic jargon. It's not everybody's cup of tea. But in any event, the idea is that for Aquinas, the ordinary mode of human cognition requires constant attention to sensation and mental imagery. That's the sort of raw data that the mind is always working over. So that an intellect without a brain, without a body, is left to its own devices, as it were. It's like a computer cut off from the internet. You know, you're streaming a video from Netflix or something, and then you lose your connectivity, and the system becomes dormant, as it were. It loses its input, and it's stuck. You can't watch anything further. And so for Aquinas, our intellects, human intellects, are so dependent on matter and on input from the senses and the brain that the mind without matter left to its own devices would be like that. So the postmortem soul for Aquinas requires really divine intervention in order to continue its cognitive operations. Now, for the Aristotelian, someone like Thomas, that's itself an argument against the Cartesian way of taking the immateriality of the mind. And it's, you might say, it's precisely, at least in part, meant to address the sort of concern you're raising, that human minds are capable of change. So if they're immaterial, how is that possible? And the answer is, at least in part, that much of what the mind does is bodily. It's not entirely bodily, but it's largely dependent on bodily processes, and bodily processes certainly involve change. So change will affect the mind in at least that indirect way. If for someone like Aquinas, if Descartes was right, human minds would be more like angelic minds, which are not in time, strictly speaking, and they don't change in the sense. There's something analogous to that in angels, but they don't change in the way that a human mind does. So anyway, this is a big question which I would answer in part that way, though again, that would take me into defending further commitments that I don't need to address in order just to defend the immateriality thesis by itself, which by itself is neutral between Descartes and Aquinas and anyone else.
Okay, we have time, 2 minutes for the last question.
Hello, so I was actually just wondering, Have you looked at objections to Ross's argument from a panpsychist perspective? So in particular, if every material thing, so you have a different kind of conception from the ordinary conception of matter, and you have kind of like a pseudo-mental conception of matter where there are determinate contents, more like Leibniz, monadology or something like that, could you determine the meaning and thus elide, difference somehow between reason and lower forms of, computation, I guess?
Well, I guess, so the question was whether what I would say in response to a panpsychist in its attempt to respond to Ross. In other words, a response to Ross that comes from the point of view of someone who thinks mind inheres in all of matter. The entire physical world is already suffused with mental properties. And what I would say to that is, I guess I would say a couple things. First of all, I would say that if we're talking about material, if we're talking about mental properties like what I referred to as qualia and intentionality, I would say that would not be sufficient to respond to Ross's argument. Because so you take qualia, for example, and qualia would be involved in mental imagery and in perceptual experiences. But as Kripke argues, and Ross is quite happy to concede this, and I'm certainly quite happy to concede this, mental imagery and bodily sensations are just as ambiguous or inexact or indeterminate in their meaning as a physical object is. That's one reason why animals who are capable of perception and mental imagery don't have rational thought processes. So if that's kind of that, if it's that kind of panpsychism that says that, well, qualia or something like them, some panpsychists call them proto-qualia, exist even at the level of fundamental particles. So, well, that doesn't really answer Ross, because he's not interested in that particular aspect of the mind. He's interested in cognition. He's interested in conceptual thought. And again, qualia is indeterminate with respect to their conceptual content as material phenomena. So that kind of panpsychist response, I think, would be completely irrelevant. Now, if you tried to somehow write even conceptual content, even in the nature of matter, I think there are all sorts of problems with doing that. But one, I think what you'd end up effectively doing is you wouldn't be reducing mind to matter. You'd be spiritualizing matter. You'd really be bringing matter up into. You'd end up with something like Leibniz's view. You mentioned Leibniz, and you know Leibniz. For Leibniz, really, there is no material world. There's just monads, which are an infinite number of mind-like entities, and they're cognizing, and the material world is just a collective virtual reality of all these things. So that if that's the panpsychist response, I would say, well, it's not really, I mean, it certainly doesn't refute Ross's claim that the mind is immaterial. It essentially concedes it and then tries to bring matter up into just a something that exists only relative to the mind. So, and since what Ross is arguing for is the mind's immateriality, I think it simply misses the point of Ross's argument. And I would reject that kind of panpsychism for all kinds of other reasons anyway, but all right.
Well, thank you so much. So let's thank Dr. Facer again.